My guest today, Boris Kogalitsky, is a director of the Institute of Globalization and Social Movements in Moscow and a well-known international commentator on Russian politics and society. Boris was a deputy to the Moscow City Soviet between 1990 and 1993, during which time he was a member of the executive of the Socialist Party of Russia, co-founder of the Party of Labor, and advisor to the chairperson of the Federation of Independent Trade Unions of Russia. Previously, he was a student of art criticism and was imprisoned for 2 years for anti-Soviet activities, first under Leonid Brezhnev in 1982 and in 1993 under Boris Yeltsin. His books, almost a score of books he's written, include Empire of the Periphery, Russia and the World System, Russia under Yeltsin and Putin, Neoliberal Autocracy, and New Realism, New Barbarism, The Crisis of Capitalism, all of which were published by Pluto Press in London. He earlier won the Deutscher Memorial Prize for his first book, The Thinking Read, Intellectuals in the Soviet State, published by Verso in 1988. Welcome, Boris Kogalitsky, to Takes on the World.
Hello.
We're glad to have you back here again with a much better line than we had the last time we spoke.
Yeah, that was really terrible. I'm sorry for that.
Well, we see progress, and we'll see if we have some political progress. It was nearly 10 years ago this month that your book, Under Yeltsin and Putin, Neoliberal Autocracy, was published by Pluto Press. And now, as of March 4th, we have Putin back as president once again. Although Dmitry Medvedev's prime minister, he has really never been away. But besides appearing to shed a tear at his current victory, what's different this time around?
Well, actually, the situation is very unclear because Putin can nominally celebrate victory, but the problem is that legitimization of the system and of the power is now really undermined. And it is not only that there was electoral fraud, because I think that was not the key issue. The key issue is that people are not happy with the way the system works, with the arrangement, with the constitution, with the rules. They want more real democracy, and in that sense, people are becoming increasingly angry at the way Russia is ruled. So in that sense, Putin is now back, but whether he's happy that he's back, it's a really big question. Now we also are facing an economic crisis which is getting worse. We're facing increasing social crisis. We're facing increasing splits in the political elite. So if you put all this together, I think, there are not so many reasons to envy Putin in his current position.
Well, I know after December mass protests of the election, they installed a very elaborate electronic surveillance program and had multitudes of observers, which actually caused some ballot stuffing. But and Putin claimed his opposition was financed by abroad, but it wasn't, I guess, the electronic surveillance that was the question, as you point out. The fact that it seems there's too much reminders of the old Soviet system in which the leadership doesn't really change.
Well, this electronic cameras, which they put everywhere, that was a real joke because, of course, it was a possibility to spend a lot of government money which went into somebody's pockets, into the pockets of those people who supplied all these web cameras. Actually, I don't know why. For some reason, Putin loves web cameras. Every time when there is a problem anywhere, he just says that, okay, we'll put web cameras. So probably have some friends in the web camera business or something like that. Anyhow, they spend millions of rubles on that. But the problem is that cameras do not show what is really happening. They're just showing the ballot boxes, how people put ballots into these boxes. But they do not really show how these ballots are being counted. So in that sense, it makes no sense, if any. But you see, the problem is not with the vote rigging. Actually, the main problem is that political parties which participate in the election are all of them represent the same government. Russian system is crafted in such a way that to launch or to register a political party, you need an agreement of the administration of the country. And in that sense, it is the presidential administration which decides who is going to run at presidential or Duma elections. This is a very odd system in which the government selects and nominates its own opposition. And, of course, they will never select anybody or any political party which really threatens them and which offers any alternative to them.
Now, I saw in the New York Times just the other day that headline, Russia to Ease the Law on Forming Political Parties, and that a new bill has been put in that is supposed to, it was proposed by Medvedev, that would provide what they call major liberalization of the ability of parties to compete. Is this largely
yes,
for show?
Yes, that's true. That's true. In fact, the bill, the way it is written now, looks quite liberal and quite good. Of course, there are some reasons to be a little less cheerful when you examine the bill in more detail, but in general, I think it's a very, very positive step, which was also becoming possible because of the mass protests in December and February. So it's a concession of the government, of the leadership to the population and to the political opposition. But this political reform, as they call it, is only its very beginning, and the problem is that they're going to start it really happening in a year from now, or maybe in 2 years from now, and it's not going to influence the current politics. So it's an odd situation when you say, we don't trust this Duma, we don't think that these elections were really democratic, and they're saying, yes, they were not, and you will probably have a better chance in like 4, 5, 6 years from now, but we have to survive these 4, 6 years, and in fact, there is no reason to think that the government will be facing no challenge and no problem before they really launch the political reform.
Now, when the United States pays a lot of attention to U.S.-Russian relations, which are very complicated. I want to get into that. How much attention do the people of Russia pay to Russia's relations with the United States as compared to here, the United States?
It's a very interesting question because the actual diplomatic relations between two countries and the actual political relations between these countries are not really debated in Russia, or at least not debated much. On the other hand, there is a lot of symbolic discussion. In that sense, one thing is the real politics, and another point is the kind of symbolic politics of Russian relations with America. And here you find a very interesting situation. Russia is becoming increasingly anti-American, but what is interesting is that the government is using anti-Americanism for domestic reasons. At the same time, they are not in any kind of serious opposition to American foreign policy. So they keep saying that, every time when there is an opposition, every time when there is a protest, every time when somebody is unhappy, every time when somebody is criticizing the government, it is because they're paid by State Department, because they're American agents, because they want to destroy or at least undermine Russia. Americans want to destroy our country. That's part of the propaganda. At the same time, every time when there is any serious question concerning Russian-American relations, whether it's on missile defense or Iran or even in case of Syria, where Russia had serious disagreements with the United States. At some point, of course, Russian leadership lays down these differences or tries to avoid conflict. So in that sense, we have this symbolic American enemy, which has very little to do with the real politics and with the real relations in Russia and America.
Well, just the other day on Monday, when President Obama and President Medvedev didn't know the recording equipment was on, Obama asked Medvedev that he needed some space, presumably when he would get reelected, in order to deal with missile offense questions that Vladimir Putin
exactly,
had.
Exactly, exactly.
And this, of course, has been played up here by the neocons and Republicans, and we have Mitt Romney, the projected Republican candidate, saying just the other day, quote, "Without question, our number one geopolitical foe is Russia." But in a member with the Left Front Party, which I believe you're connected with, was quoted in a New York Times supplement the other day, Sergei Udaltsev, saying, Putin is Russia's most pro-Western politician, that he shut down the Soviet military bases in Cuba and Vietnam. He allowed NATO to expand to the territory of the former Soviet Union by admitting the Baltic republics in the early 2000s, and he keeps Russian budget money in American treasury bonds.
Well, that's exactly true, though I am not very happy with Sergei Udaltsev and his group, the Left Front, which basically is avoiding any serious discussion of social and economic problems of Russia, just concentrating their fire on Putin personally, as if all the problems are just produced by the individual evil presented by Putin rather than by the system. But anyhow, speaking about the practical policies of Russian government, I mean, yes, they have certain specific interests which they defend, which they try to protect internationally, but these are not the interests of Russia. These are mainly the interests of particular big corporations. So in that sense, in Russia, capitalism is very concrete. It's not even getting to the level of national interests or state interests like in major capitalist countries since 19th century or 18th century even, or maybe even in case of Russia under the Tsars, they had some idea of national interest, no matter how distorted. In case of today's Russian capitalism, it's very concrete. These are the interests of specific Russian corporations, Russian companies, which are involved in specific deals and specific projects, specific competition somewhere. And the government actually acts as the agent, following their orders and doing what they say. That's why, for example, when Gazprom had problems with the Ukrainian government, Russian government, Russian leadership just followed Gazprom, and they were fiercely attacking Ukraine to defend the interests of Gazprom then. You could say, well, okay, Ukraine was also somehow hostile towards Russia during this period, but then they went after Belarus the same way. And Belarus, no matter what we say about Lukashenko and his regime, Belarus was a geopolitical ally of Russia, and Russian government went after Belarus in the same fierce way as it did in case of Ukraine. Why? Because the interests of Gazprom in both cases were exactly the same. Also, if we're talking in the case of Syria, it's not that Russia has specific interests in Syria, but it's very important that some Russian military industrial companies are interested in keeping their sales of armaments to Syria, and that's the only reason they're backing Bashar Assad regime so far. In reality, it's not that they have some other reasons. It's just they want the contracts which are signed by the regime to be really carried out. Once the contracts are over, I think they will surrender Bashar Assad the next day.
But doesn't Russia have some geopolitical interest in keeping at least one country in the region on the Soviet side, excuse me, the Russian side.
Well, but it's not on the Russian side. I mean, it's Russia on Bashar Assad's side. It's very little that Russia is actually interested in this region in terms of long-term perspective. It's not the case of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had a long-term perspective. It had its own vision of long-term relationships with the governments and the countries and even with the peoples of the region. By the way, don't forget, Soviet Union did train hundreds of thousands of specialists in the Arab world. And by the way, when I visited Syria, I discovered that it was very easy to communicate in Russian in Damascus, meeting Syrian intelligentsia, because so many people were trained in the Soviet Union. Of course, all these people were on the side of the opposition.
Interesting, interesting. My guess is Boris Kagalitsky, we're talking to him in Moscow. Getting back to the Russian capitalist, under Yeltsin, we had the greatest, probably the greatest giveaway of natural resources in the history of the world to what became the robber barons or the oligarchs of Russia. Maybe you could describe how that happened.
Well, that was easy. You told me we were just dividing the public sector, cutting it into pieces, and everybody tried to swallow the piece as big as possible. What's happening now is that under Putin, for some time, they stopped this plunder, partly because they were trying to stabilize Russian capitalism. You cannot simply plunder the country without any end. By the way, it was not so much plunder which was left. I mean, you cannot just run a country by looting its resources and companies and enterprises and so on. So Putin's stage of Russian capitalism, unlike Yeltsin's stage, it was about normalizing capitalism. It was about stabilizing it. It was about making it more or less work. But now, with the economic crisis, the situation of Putin is becoming unstable because, the economy is doing not so well. And yes, the oil prices are high, but the dollar is getting weaker in its purchasing power. So you get maybe more dollar bills, but you're not happy with what you can buy with these dollar bills. And, you know this problem in the United States as well, I guess. So, in that sense, Putin's compromise and Putin's model of normalization, which is based on this shower of petrodollars, which had to satisfy everybody, including certain sections of the population, including some toiling masses, in a way, who also got situation improving somewhat. That's over. Situation is becoming completely different, and the government doesn't know what to do about it.
One of these ex-oligarchs, I wanted to get back to that for a moment, Mikhail Khodorkovsky has become kind of a popular hero in elements of the United States and the Vanity Fair, one of the biggest American magazines in terms of at least advertising, has an article just recently called The Wrath of Putin, showing Putin sitting like a dictator in a chair. And it's all about the trials, tribulations of Khodorkovsky, who the writer, who's a friend of Putin's, a friend of Khodorkovsky, claims is a competitor for Putin in Russia. How much popularity does Khodorkovsky actually have?
Well, of course, he doesn't have any popularity among the majority of people. In fact, it is exactly the attack on Khodorkovsky which made Putin somewhat popular with millions of people. Quite a lot of people were not happy that this attack stopped with Khodorkovsky and Putin didn't go after the rest of the oligarchy. And, of course, that was natural because what Putin was doing, he was again trying to normalize Russian capitalism. So what was the policy? The policy was to move from oligarchic capitalism to some kind of corporate capitalism and to make everybody behave. So that those who didn't behave, they had to be punished. Putin himself, he acted like a teacher in a class. Well, you kids, you children, you have to follow some order and follow some rules, and it's in your own interest. And Khodorkovsky was not learning the lesson. He was misbehaving. He was trying to overthrow Putin. He was trying to buy the deputies in the Duma. Actually, the government said, no, we control the Duma. We control who are the deputies. We control the politicians. We control the government, I mean, the ministers. And Khodorkovsky tried to do that in a direct way, just buying individual deputies or factions to control them from his own side. So at some point, Putin just said, no, that's against the rule. We just have one state where we decide. And that was basically the story. And it's about power struggle, and there is very little which makes Khodorkovsky look like any kind of Democrat.
Well, there was one thing that this long article, Vanity Fair, didn't mention it, but I recall at the time, just before Khodorkovsky, who was the owner of Yukos Oil, was arrested. There was a small item in the Financial Times that he was going to sell 20% of Yukos Oil to Exxon, and I thought that might have some bearing on Putin's action arresting him. But now it seems I've heard that Exxon has deals now with Russia, with Rosneft, the main Russian oil company.
Well, I don't think it was an attempt to sell Yukos, or at least some shares of Yukos to Exxon, which made Putin angry. I think it was the other way around. When Khodorkovsky understood that Putin was getting really angry, he decided to sell some shares to American companies in order to protect them himself, thinking that, okay, Putin would probably not dare do anything against Yukos once Yukos is partly controlled by the Americans. So that says Putin just had to act very fast before Khodorkovsky managed to do anything like that. And it's not about anybody being against Americans or American interests in Russia. On the contrary, I think both sides are pro-American in the sense that both sides want American capital and both sides want the world to stay the way it is. They're pretty conservative. But they are in a disagreement about who's going to run Russia for America, if you want, or for American capital, rather.
Well, it's all these different relationships, there are so many in which U.S. and Russia interact. One of the most interesting ones is Afghanistan. Now, I've always had a hunch, it's just a hunch, that the Russian assistance or support of U.S. in Afghanistan is to have America, the United States, have the same experience in Afghanistan that the Soviet Union had. But maybe you could explain from your point of view there, the Russian-U.S. relationship toward Afghanistan.
Well, I don't think, again, that Russia has much of a policy towards Afghanistan. Of course, in many ways, Russian military and political establishment feels some sort of happiness about Americans having all the same problems which Soviet Union used to have. And they are now thinking, okay, now let Americans have this than us. But at the same time, I think they are worried about what's happening in Afghanistan because they think that Afghanistan can become a really dangerous place for the whole region. And they don't know whether it's better if Americans stay or leave. They don't know what to do with Afghanistan if Americans leave, whether they're going to try to establish some sort of good relations with the post-American, post-occupation government there, or rather try to pretend that Afghanistan doesn't exist and just try to support the governments in the Central Asian republics, the governments which are still quite dependent on Russia and quite connected to Russia. So in all these respects, I don't think we have a clear policy.
My guest is Boris Kagalitsky, and we in Moscow. It's now 14 minutes before the hour, and you open the phones. If any of you have comments or questions, the number here, of course, is 895-2448. We also had the situation with a confrontation a few years back over Georgia, which put the U.S. and Russia on different sides. And how is that, the Russian recognition, Russia's recognizing Ossetia, which upsets Georgia. How is that situation today?
Well, you must remember that it was first Georgia which attacked South Ossetia, which provoked Russian government to officially recognize the independence of South Ossetia. So in that sense, it was very much the Georgian provocation which forced Moscow to react. Of course, Georgian leadership under Mikhail Saakashvili, which in many ways is very similar to that of Russia. I think the way both countries are governed, it's very, very similar. So I think they also wanted to speed up confrontation, thinking that Russia wouldn't dare to really fight back as long as Russians knew that Americans backed Georgians. But what Georgians didn't understand, I mean Georgian leaders, of course, was that on the one hand they were pushing too far so that Russia was kind of unable to pretend that nothing was happening. It was really forced to fight back. And second point is that Russia was also quite important for the United States and for American foreign policy and American companies, so that America was backing Georgia, but to a certain level. So America was not going to fight a war with Russia for Georgia's interests. And in that sense, Georgian leadership in Tbilisi miscalculated quite dramatically. And on the other hand, it was Moscow which calculated correctly that Americans were going to say a few angry words, but nothing else.
Thank you. We have a first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm hoping your thank you once again, Jeffrey. I'm hoping your caller can address a little attended issue, and that would be relative to Obama's recent conference in Seoul and the deproliferation issues. And when the Soviet Union broke up, all of this nuclear material that was left and continues to be untracked and unguarded. I wonder if he can make any comments about that situation and how it plays on the world field. Thank you.
Well, I don't think that this is correct. I mean, this is a kind of American interpretation of what happened, because the nuclear material and the nuclear arsenal was never left uncontrolled or unguarded. There was some mess in the process, but in Russia there is always mess. I mean, that's just, I don't think there was more mess than it was before. I mean, it's just part of the normal mess, no more than that. And, as you know, Russia accepted the status of a nuclear power, while other countries of the former Soviet Union refused that, so that all this nuclear material, the weapons and other elements of the system, they were all brought to Russia. And quite a lot was withdrawn from Ukraine, from the Ukrainian Republic, for example. And quite a lot was also withdrawn from Kazakhstan. So now it's all quite well concentrated in the Russian territory. And, Rosatom, for example, if you take peaceful segment of the nuclear industry, it's a very strong cooperation, which is very close to the government. And the military, of course, are very much in control of what remains, what is remaining of the nuclear power of the former Soviet Union, though it's getting less and less important because Russia is not investing in the replacement of these weapons, so the they're kind of getting out of date, but I don't think it's very important in the sense that, well, hopefully we will not need, no country will ever need to use these terrible things.
Well, thanks for that, and thanks for that question, caller. One thing I want to talk to you about is the relationship between Russia and Israel around Iran and their and the Palestinian situation. I know Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel from Moldova, Russia is one of the few places where he is welcome. Vladimir Putin said he's going to visit Israel this coming summer, yet Russia is one of the countries that is preventing or not going along with the U.S.-Israel plan to totally economically strangle Iran. It's a part of the so-called quartet that is supposed to deal with Israel-Palestine relationship, but doesn't seem to play any role there. How does it look from your perspective?
In the case of Iran, the situation is very clear. Russia has a lot of economic interests. Again, not Russia, rather Russian corporations, Russian companies, which are now at work there. And, of course, they don't want to lose their investment. That's about it. As for the case of Palestine, for example, it's exactly the other way around. Russia doesn't have important investments in Palestine. Neither they have very important investment in Israel. So they're not really very interested in these countries. And that's why Russian presence in the quartet is so weak. They don't know what to do there, and they don't know what are they standing for. However, of course, leaving and just saying we're not part of this process is also politically impossible because, again, status is important. We cannot just say, okay, we don't know what to do about these problems, so we're just going to quit. No country will ever do it, I think, no government. So they will rather pretend that they're in while, in fact, they're out.
Well, one of the things, obviously, if there is an attack by either the U.S. or and or Israel on Iran, it will have a major impact on Russia. And not on Russia, but the entire region. Is there much public discussion of the potential of a possibility of a war in Iran?
Well, of course, the Russian oil industry would love a war to happen because that would increase the price of oil. And that's the only thing they're interested in. But on the other hand, the Russian atomic industry, the nuclear industry, is not interested in this war to happen because that would lead to some of their contracts being not properly carried out. That's the dilemma, in a way. But I think Iranians are not going to go as far as to fight a war. Neither will Americans. I think the only really dangerous element of this of the situation is Israel, because Israel is they have some leaders who are crazy enough as to launch a military operation, even unilaterally, trying to push the United States into a conflict following them. But still, even this is, I think, going a little too far. I think, again, we can probably imagine that some of the Israeli hawks are a bit crazy. But, well, how crazy they are in reality, it's another question. Because, again, my guess is that they rather play crazy. They rather try to pretend that they're crazy so to make everybody afraid. So you don't know what to do with these crazy people. You have to stay away from them. Have to be worried, and so on. But I think they're not as crazy as they seem. So in that sense, I don't think that the war is any close in the Middle East.
Well, it's interesting. Some years ago, Moshe Dayan, the former Israeli general, said that's what the role Israel should play, act as a mad dog, and people will be afraid about what we're going to do. We do have another caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm concerned about Syria and the 8,000 people who've been killed there. I wonder if Russia is exerting as much pressure as it could on Assad to make sure that he stops killing his people and gives them democracy so that they can actually vote and choose who they want to be ruled by. The 70% of the Sunnis obviously are opposed by the 20% of the Alawites. What can Russia do?
I'm sorry, I didn't really get it because the line was broken.
Okay.
Can you repeat the main point?
Well, I could do it for she was talking about what can Russia do about the 8,000 people who've been killed in Syria, and how can Russia support the aspirations of the Syrian people?
Well, again, you must understand, when you say Russia, I am not responsible for the Russian government, as you can imagine. I am very much in support of the Arab Spring and of the democratic struggles in Syria. And, of course, pressure on Assad regime is quite necessary. Though, on the other hand, I think it's not so much the business of the West to be part of it. I think the Arab League is in the right position to put pressure on Syria if necessary. And, of course, we have to support the Syrian opposition in its struggle, but I think any kind of direct Western intervention in the region would be a disaster. And I don't think that so much good can be done by any kind of Western intervention in the region, because in the long run, when the West moves in, it's not to make people of the region happy. We may remember Lawrence of Arabia, who led the uprising of Arabs against Turks, which was in many ways a popular uprising, and it was in many ways a just struggle, a struggle for liberation. But once Western powers really moved in, they didn't lead Arab nations, Arab peoples, to freedom and liberation and democracy. Instead, they established a colonial system in the Middle East. And, of course, now we're not in the 20th century anymore, and the situation is different. And still, there are reasons to be very doubtful about the positive impact Western intervention can make. So in that sense, the situation is difficult. I think we have to support the opposition politically and probably help arming the opposition. But it's better if the West is staying away from the actual control.
And on that note, Boris, we're coming to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us from Moscow, and wish you all the best. And again, thanks for being our guest on Takes on the World, enlightening us about what's going on in Russia. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.